interesting Rashis from a part of the Parsha that people don't often study, don't often pay attention to, because it's a little bit anticlimactic. What could be more anticlimactic than the section right after Oziyashir? So we arrive at Mara, and as I mentioned the last night, Shir HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivers a sampling of mitzvos, Dinim, Shabbos, Paraduma, according to some, Girsos, Kibbut Evo'im. You know how the Girsos changed, because it was written Pei Aleph, so in some Girsos it was Kaf Aleph. So Pei Aleph is Paraduma, Kaf Aleph is Kibbut Evo'im. You have to study like one of the most original sources. But Rashi at least quotes the Paraduma version, Paraduma Girsa. Anyway, so they get to Mara. Sham Sam Lo Choku Mishpat, HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivered these mitzvahs, V'sham Nisahu. And he also tested them. What was he testing them for, and how do they do on the test? So Rashi says he tested them to see if they're Kshei Oref. And according to Rashi, Hashem discovered that they were Kshei Oref. And does that mean they passed the test or they failed the test? That's not clear. Because normally when Hashem realizes that we're Kshei Oref, that's a negative. Hashem tells us in Kitisa, you're Kshei Oref, so I can't walk with you through the Midbar. I have to send my Malach because I know that you're going to constantly fail me. And if I live amongst you, then the punishments will be too lethal. So I'll just send my Malach. I'll create a little distance. Generally, when Hashem realizes that we're Kshei Oref, that means that we get punished or we get distance. Or here, you don't see any aftermath. Oh, I realize you were Kshei Oref. We'll see how he realized we're Kshei Oref, that you're stubborn. Now that I tested you and I realized in Mara you're Kshei Oref, therefore, what am I going to do? There's no change in our relationship. I'm still not a punishment for being Kshei Oref. If anything, what happens after Hashem realizes we're Kshei Oref? He gives us the Torah, the Parshas Yisro. The immediate aftermath of Parshas Bishalach is the delivery of the Torah. That's the next step of Hashem. Obviously, Amalek comes, but that's not Hashem's decision, that's Amalek's decision. So this reinforces something very interesting that the Kuzari mentions. That Kshei Oref works both ways. On the one hand, stubbornness can be a flaw, wooden-headed, obstinate, intransigent. We just saw Paro. Again, whether you call him stubborn or Kvad Lev or Chazek Hashem's Lev Paro, but he's too stubborn for his own good. And some of stubbornness could be resilience, defiance, stick-to-itiveness, perseverance. Just think of the last 2,000 years. Would we have survived if we wouldn't have been so stubborn? Would we be surviving now during this crisis if we weren't so stubborn? The Kuzari says, that's why Hashem chose us. Hashem chose us to deliver the Torah, and chose Avram, of course, because he realized, it's a fascinating concept, that Jews, one of the traits Jews possess, he claims, very genetically almost, is that we're stubborn people. Right? That's sometimes, when's the last time you were on an LL plane? When's the last time you were driving Israeli roads? When's the last time you were trying to pass judicial reform, or oppose judicial reform in Israel? It gets very heated because Jews are very opinionated, they're very confident, they're very brash, they believe deeply. I think, I believe anti-Semitism is deeply, deeply, deeply rooted in metaphysical realities, and we'll talk about this maybe a little bit later. But if you look at it through a fresh set of eyes, sometimes the way we behave, which we're accustomed to, which other people aren't accustomed to, very opinionated, this is confident. Some people look at that and are awkward or uncomfortable with it. I'm not justifying chassidim anti-Semitism. I'm just saying we have certain traits that, if not properly moderated and channeled, can come across in ways that can be impolite, and we'll talk about that in a moment. So it's fascinating that Hashem tested us, and he discovered that we were Kshei Oref, we'll see in a moment, and therefore he gave us the Torah, which reinforces the Kuzari's position that Kshei Oref was one of the reasons Hashem chose us. Now, how did Hashem discover that we were Kshei Oref? Like, what did he do? Did he give us a stubborn test? Did he call shrinks, Egyptian shrinks, to come put us on the sofa in the desert and test whether we were stubborn? So Hashem, Rashi says, because when we asked for water, we weren't polite. When we asked for water, got to Marash, it is a Marash, look, we're a little thirsty. It's been a long trip. Our water supplies are running dry. Can you please give us some water? Instead, they started complaining. Vayilonu ha'amal Moshe banishta. Since they weren't polite, then it proved that they were stubborn. Wait a second. What do those two things have to do with one another? I know people that are polite. I know people that are impolite. I know people that are stubborn. I know people that aren't stubborn. Is there a tzad hashava between them? Just because they were impolite, Hashem saw they were stubborn. That's what Rashi says. Sham niso, la'am, v'reik she'arpan. Hashem saw that they were stubborn. Shalom nimluchu b'moshe b'lashen yafa. They didn't speak to Moshe kindly. Please, Moshe, ask Hashem for water. Ella, lislodanu. They argue, they complain. What does impoliteness have to do with stubbornness? When you dig down and you try to find the common denominator, like a brisker sugya, you'll be able to understand those two traits a little better. These are traits that sometimes are slogans. Don't be stubborn. Be polite. What does it mean to be stubborn? Where does it come from? Where does politeness come from? What's the challenge to be polite? They come from the same core as follows. There's always an ideal in life that you should aspire towards, the way things should be, the perfect state in this world, in your surroundings, hopefully in yourself. And people that don't have an aspiration to reach that ideal are very mediocre, they're very apathetic, they're very indifferent, they just accept their reality. One of the traits I want to give you in this yeshiva, we want to give you, is ambition. Try to change your life, try to change this world, try to have ambition in religion, not just have a car and a house, but try to leave this world having made a difference, having made an imprint. One day you'll leave this world, will the world be better and different based on the fact that you lived here? If you're only a taker, then the world probably is worse, maybe neutral, for you having lived on this planet. How can you change? That doesn't have to be highfalutin changes. It could be raising a family and being a community member and learning Torah and performing mitzvahs. That makes change in the world, even if it's not discernible to the naked eye. It's not going to be covered in headlines. I'm going to get 1,000 likes, but you brought us into this world. What happens when the ideal falls short? What happens when around you, and that's one of the challenges in life, to be an idealist, but to also be a realist and a pragmatist, and to respond, not just to, hey, look at Yosef, who was an idealist, and what lengths he goes through to implement his ideals versus you, who's a responder, right, to our first responders. So when you feel that your ideal isn't met, you have to pivot, you have to change. Sometimes people are so idealist that it's hard for them to change, and they're stubborn. This is the way it is, this is the way it should be, this is the way I want it to be, this is what I think is right, I'm not going to change, I don't want to accept anything less. So she'orif sometimes is too much idealism. It's not selfishness. People that are stubborn are not selfish. It's a different trait. Don't conflate the two. People that are stubborn have a hard time giving up on a certain ideal or narrative or picture in their mind and saying, you know what, power had a certain narrative, and look how long it took him to give up that narrative and realize, Hashem etzadik v'aniv v'mehor shayim. That same challenge to, on the one hand, aim for an ideal, but also pivot when the ideal isn't met, to a degree is also whether you're polite or not. Like, what difference does it make how I ask? I deserve water, right? So, well, I'm asking in a nice way. Not, I deserve water. You're not giving me the water. Here's my water. I want it in this politeness. I come from Brooklyn. You know, I don't have to sit there at the table and say please 5 times. I deserve it. Polite means even though you deserve something, you treat people with respect and you follow convention and your interactions are kind and respectful. What do you mean? Why should I be? If I deserve something, I deserve something. If I don't deserve something, I'll understand. I'll ask and plead. But if I deserve something, come on, come to my share, and I deserve you to... It's the same context that we live in a world in which not every ideal will always be implemented. And when you live in a fallen world, how do you react to that? Are you obstinate and say, this can't be, and I'm going to hold out, and only fight? And also, are you polite to people when you ask for things, when you interact with them? I'm not talking about politeness when you don't deserve something. That's not politeness. That's you're asking for something you don't deserve. And politeness, when you just interact with people, they deserved water. That's clear. They've just been taken out of Mitzrayim. They didn't commit any sins. They deserve to be fed water. Politeness means, okay, you deserve it, but ask in the right way. And realize that the ideal won't always be served to you. And that's what they're being lessons. Hashem says, I realize by your impoliteness that you're stubborn, which is a good trait, because you have an ideal that you won't give up on. Could you imagine if we gave up on returning to Israel over the last 2,000 years? Could you imagine if we gave up on Torah over the last 2,000 years? There's an ideal we stick to, but sometimes, and that's why Jews aren't always polite, sometimes on buses and public settings. So that's the overlay or the overlap between the two. Okay. Miriam has her own mini Az Yashir, which she directs betupim uvim cholos, with musical instruments. How did they get musical instruments in the desert? Where did that come from? They went to the music store. They ordered it on Amazon and desert delivery. How did they get tupim and mecholos? So Rashi says that the tzidkanios, the righteous women, realized and had emuna that Geula was coming, so they brought musical instruments. So there's a lot to unpack here. First of all, why did the women have more emuna and Geula than the men? Is it just something internally righteous about women? Is it they were working less intensely and therefore the kotzer ruach and the avodah kasha was less stifling for them than it was for the men? Is it the capacity of women to see things a little differently than reality, an alternate reality? Is it just that men and women have different processors? and men are more grounded and rational. Women are more emotional. You know the famous book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, which traces certain, again, in our world, that's not PC to assume that men and women have different inclinations. But is this something we can trace throughout Tanakh, where Rivka sees what Yitzchak can't see, literally, where Sarah sees what Avram can't see? Right? She saw, she was godel from Avram in Nevuah, Rashi says. So she saw that Yishmael was toxic and had to be evicted. Miriam herself saw what her father couldn't see. Remember that medrash I told you about a few weeks ago, where Amram separates from his wife and Miriam sees the broader picture? Is this a capacity that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave women? And to a degree, is this why women are patur from mitzvos? Because mitzvos is one processor that you approach Hashem. Zman grama, at least, not mitzvos. So is this a moment in which we're being reminded that Hashem gave women a certain capacity to see geula in the future that men cannot? And how is this playing out in our world today that we're so close to geula, but we're having a hard time seeing through the cloud? Are women seeing things that we're not seeing? It's fascinating to think about that in this Rashi. Now, the second thing which is fascinating, okay, so you think geula is coming around the corner. What do you bring? What would you bring if Mashiach's coming tomorrow? What would be the first thing you'd get ready? Let's say you lived in Vancouver, and you're getting on a plane to Israel, and Mashiach's coming, I'll bring a Tanakh, maybe bring, a par, bring a lot of korbanos, take a cow on the plane with you, buy a seat for your cow. Like, what would you bring? I would bring something functional. Like, how is the Mashiach experience going to feel? What will I need in Mashiach's time? Maybe bring a gun if I feel it'll be go-go-mago. What would I bring? And here they're bringing musical instruments. I remember Yaakov back in Parshas Vayigash. He goes to Be'er Sheva. He also has a premonition of Geula. What does he do? He cuts down Atzei Shittim and he brings it down to Mitzrayim because functionally they're going to need Atzei Shittim when they build the Mishkan and they won't have it in the Midbar. So Yaakov is very functional. Miriam and the other righteous women, they're much more poetic. It's just, we want to celebrate HaKadosh Baruch Hu when Geula comes. We're trying so hard to achieve geula. And David HaMelech says this a lot in Tehillim. I want you to redeem me and to save me so that I can praise you. Not for myself, not for my own salvation, that as well, but I want to reach a state of being closer to you, and when I'm redeemed and the world is clearer, then I'll feel close to you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I'll praise you. Shir Lashem ki gamal alai. Once you're gamal alai, I'll praise you, and I promise, not just a tit for tat, if you save me, I'll praise you. Shir Lashem ki gamal alai, when? So these women were not just waiting for geula and trying to think functionally, but geula will bring with it a degree of intimacy and proximity to Hashem, and we're going to celebrate that through music. Now, it's also interesting, and think about that today, the role of music and artistic expression when we're redeemed. When we're redeemed, it's such a powerful and deep experience that it elicits creativity within the human spirit. And one of the ways it manifests itself, I don't know if you guys play musical instruments, but it's a language, and it's an expression. I think about that a lot today, because over the last 100 years, Jewish music has transmogrified. If you go back 200 years ago, there is no such thing as Jewish music. There are a couple shtetl ditties, but between you and me, they're not very musical. I heard them. There's chazanos, but that's not Jewish music. That's just an embellishment to tefillah. But if you go back and say, you know, the big question you guys face in high school, should you listen to Jewish music or non-Jewish music? That wasn't a question 300 years ago. There was only non-Jewish music. You could have chosen not to listen to non-Jewish music. That's fine. We could have listened, but there was no choice. Let's listen to Mordechai Ben David and to Shreki, and to, it didn't exist. And now that we're being redeemed, two things are happening. First of all, the burst of Jewish music outside of Israel. I don't know the names, but you guys probably know the names better than I do. But also, something that's less familiar to you, but it may be, there's a whole genre of Israeli music. And now, of course, there's Israeli rock and roll, which is just, you know, there's no spirit to it. It's just like American rock and roll with a beat. But there's a whole genre of soulful Israeli music. I don't know if you've been exposed to it. And you can turn it on the radio on Friday, where it's not based on Pesukim of Tanakh, but you feel the neshama of Am Yisrael coming through. And you feel something deeply spiritual about it, deeply soulful about it. And even from people in Chutz Lars are starting to discover this whole genre of music. For example, Naomi Shemer would be the classic example, Yishalayim Shel Zahav. She's not a religious woman per se. She's not quoting Midrashim per se. But you feel as if there's a neshama of Am Yisrael, the yearning for Geula that's being expressed in music in ways that it wasn't in the past. I remember my parents telling me how much glee they had as youngsters, I guess in the 50s, when Shlomo Kalbach's Essa Einai came out. That was like the modern song that broke with all the old dirges of the past. Essa Einai, yeah. That was like the big hit. And thus we see it as old and ancient because we have so many jazzy, upbeat songs. But it's fascinating that after this geula, there's a renaissance of music to celebrate the moment, and we're living through that experience again as we're inching towards the end of history and our people are being redeemed. Music is trying to capture the spirit of our people and of our imagination. I'll just take one more minute only because it's an important, really very quickly, Tivla'imo Aretz. And while we discuss the fact that the Egyptians were tossed in the sea, Neshafta Bruchacha Kisamayam Telukah Farasamayim Madirim, so we also mentioned Natisa Yeminchas Kadosh Baruch Hu, you extended your hand, Tivayachal, Tivla'imo Aretz, and the ground swallowed them. This, according to Rashi, is not a continuation of the punishment. This is a description of their minimal schar. What was their schar? That despite all the tossing in the ocean, what happens when a person drowns in the ocean? Generally, the body washes up on shore. And at some point, again, there are records of it washing up on shore, but at some point, if we follow Rashi literally, the bodies washed up on shore, and then they were swallowed by the ground, Tivlei Maritz. The tide came in, the ground became a little bit soft, whatever, but the bodies didn't stay on the shore for long. The Jews saw them, but at some point they were buried. Why? Because they had a schus. What schus did they have that they deserve burial? Because in Mitzrayim, in the end of Bara, they say, Hashem HaSadik Vaniva Miharshim. Because Pyro said that, and everyone bought into it, so they acknowledge the Kaddish Baruch Hu. So we see the premium and the value that we place on burying people, not letting their bodies be defiled or desecrated or mutilated or lying on the open field. And the Egyptians were Zochet to Kavur, even the Egyptians, because of the Schos. And over the last 100 years, the two horrific episodes that we've lived through, which included so many other forms of torture and attacks against our people, but as well as that, the fact that so many Jews were not Zochet to be buried in Europe. And unfortunately, this is still evolving now. How many Jews on October 7th were their remains desecrated? How many people were in Zochet to full kvur? Where are the bodies? What happened to the bodies? So we just remember that we celebrate Tzelem Elokim, not just in our neshama, but in our bodies. And our bodies are a reflection of Hashem. And all the heroes that you don't know about in the background spent weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks seeing things and dealing with things that will last and leave scars on them for their entire life. People carrying bones literally across the world, just to forensic laboratories across the world to try to identify people and try to identify remains. So when you read this pasuk, Tivlei Maharetz, the Egyptians were Zochet to Kavura, and unfortunately, at this point, many of our people were not. So three interesting Rashis. One is we were tested, were we stubborn? And it turns out we were stubborn, and because of that, we received the Torah. How did Hashem determine we were stubborn? Because we were impolite. How does impoliteness reflect stubbornness and obstinacy? Number two, the Tzidkanios brought out musical instruments, drums and harps, to play the songs after Kriyas Yamsuf. Why did women see Geula more than men? Why did women think not in functional terms, but in artistic terms? How does music reflect the renaissance of the Jewish spirit under redemptive experiences? And then finally, the Egyptians were Zochet to Kvura. We hope to never, ever undergo the horror in which Jews are not Zochet to Kvura. Okay? Have a good day, everyone. Thank you for coming. You're welcome. You're